Welcome back to the Stanford Psychology Podcast, where leading psychologists share their most recent work. I'm Rachel, and for this week's episode, I'm excited to chat with Dr. Moshe Hoffman. Moshe is a lecturer at Harvard's Department of Economics, where he uses game theory, models of learning and evolution, and behavioral experiments to investigate the role that incentives play in shaping our behavior and beliefs. His recent book, Hidden Games, co-authored with MIT research scientist Erez Ueli, explores how game theory can explain seemingly irrational human behavior, from the excesses of royal coronations to the misfires of World War I snipers. In this conversation, Moshe and I discuss evolutionary explanations for why we're so bad at giving effectively, how symbolic phrases like I love you enable social coordination, and why we find the music of rapper MF Doom so appealing. Moshe has previously worked at Harvard's Department of Mathematics, MIT's Media Lab, and the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Biology. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Moshe Hoffman. Moshe Hoffman, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. I really enjoyed reading your recent book, Hidden Games, The Surprising Power of Game Theory to Explain Irrational Human Behavior, and it's great to have you here. So I thought we could start off by discussing some recent work of yours that focuses on the relationship between empathy and social incentives. Could you maybe give a brief overview of that work and what drew you to thinking about empathy through the lens of motivations and incentives?
Yeah. So obviously, empathy is going to be determined by many things. It will also be determined by things that we usually think of as independent forces, like the reputational benefits that you get from giving, or the financial benefits, like how costly it is to give. That might also affect how much empathy you feel. So we had some like very basic experiments that demonstrate this. We have people giving to like this GoFundMe charity where you see pictures and a story about a baby in need. And it's meant to evoke empathy, and that's meant to motivate you to give. But we manipulate a few things. One is how costly it is for you to give. So we tell people, if you have, say, $100 that you could give to this charity, you can either do that. We as the experimenter will pay the $100, or you could go home with it. And that's one condition. Or in another condition, you could either give $100 to the charity, or you can go home with $100 yourself. So in both cases, the GoFundMe campaign could get $100 or you can act selfishly, but how much you would benefit from acting selfishly differs. And we find, not surprisingly, people are more giving when it costs them less to do so. When it costs you $100 instead of 50, people give less. Okay, that's not so surprising, but we also find, at least according to self-reporting measures, that people also self-report feeling less empathetic afterwards. Yeah, so we tell them first exactly what the decision is going to be. So before they read all this material and look at all the photos, they know how costly it's going to be. And if they know it's going to be very costly, they might decide, oh, I really don't want to partake in this. And they're not going to look closely at the photos. They're not going to think about it. They might do whatever they can in their mind to desensitize themselves. That makes them, in turn, feel less empathetic towards the person. And so that's one of the experiments that we have. Another experiment is we tell them that somebody's going to be able to observe what you give to this GoFundMe. And they'll choose whether to play a trust game with you or another person, or how much to send you in a trust game. And so you have this social benefit from behaving in a way that might make you look more trustworthy. And in that case, also people give more, obviously, then also report being more empathetic for presumably similar reasons. So the basic story that we're trying to tell here, maybe it sounds like a little bit nuanced or esoteric, but the story really is that things that are often maybe you heard about or talked to other people on this podcast about, like the proximate ultimate distinction. Well, maybe I'll re-summarize quickly. But the idea is that at one level, you can ask why do we do things like give to charity, and you could give a proximate explanation because it feels good to give or because you feel compelled by your empathic reaction. That would be a proximate explanation for why you give. And of course, things like empathy and warm glow come from somewhere. One question you can ask is how sensitive is empathy to those things, and how rapidly does it respond to those things? And how important is it to think about things that shape empathy? Or can we just ignore those functional stuff and just focus on empathy right now because it's relatively fixed and stable, and whatever shaped it 100,000 years ago is no longer terribly important or relevant. I guess part of what we're trying to show in this experiment is actually not only does empathy often serve a real function, like it might get you to give in ways that are going to give you social rewards, but it's going to respond to those things in very real time. And that tells you that you can't just focus on, if you really want to understand people's behavior, you really don't want to just focus on the proximate stuff like empathy, which is often going to be dodged and escaped by more functional stuff like the social returns and like how costly it is. So let me give one more example and then we can move on. I really love history. So I read a lot of history. And one important time period in history that's obviously significant for understanding human behavior and obviously seeing the dark side of humanity is you read about the Holocaust, which I spent a lot of time reading about. And I guess one classic book on the Holocaust is called Ordinary Men. Now, Ordinary Men is about the Einsatzgruppe, which is this group of men who are too old or not fit enough to go to the front in Eastern Europe, the Nazi soldiers, German soldiers. But since they were an older generation or not particularly fit, they weren't sent to the front to fight, but instead they were sent behind the lines, and they just thought they were doing like policing duties. But in fact, what they were doing is they were rounding up civilians and killing them in the forest. So these people, they ended up being some of the most horrible criminals in history. And so Ordinary Men is a book about one battalion, Battalion 101, and about like from the first time they were given this assignment, how they got accustomed to it. And one of the main arguments in the book is that for the most part, these people, they weren't selected for being hardened Nazis. They were often Germans from a part of the country and a generation that wasn't particularly, you know, hardened in the Nazi ideology. And they didn't like volunteer for this job thinking that what they were going to do is kill women and children. But that was, in fact, the assignment that they were given. And so what the book talks about is how on the first day, these people, as is natural, they had a very strong empathic reaction to the people that they were killing. They found it really hard. So they would throw up. They would shoot and miss. They would pretend to be so that they could avoid the duty. They would hide. They really didn't want to do this job because it's normal human reaction is to like feel really bad when you shoot innocent people. But what the book talks about is how they managed over time. And this connects to the silly experiments that we ran, which is that, well, if you just stop there, you just think, okay, empathy is really causally important. You might think, okay, well then, you know, great. People feel empathy. It's going to really make it hard for us to commit atrocities. You might success story. You read the first few pages of this book and you think, great, we don't have to worry about things like the Holocaust. But of course, we all know what happened in history. And if you read past the first pages, you realize that actually their starting point of feeling empathy didn't actually stop them from committing the evil task they were given. And because like in our experiments, they had huge incentives to be doing this task and huge reasons to try and ameliorate their sense of empathy. So they would get things like promotion. They would get things like be able to continue avoiding the front. They would get things like very good ration if they continue this task. Okay. And so many of them got over their sense of empathy by doing things like getting really drunk. So it turns out it's a lot easier to shoot innocent people when you're drunk. And so that's what they would do before they were assigned this task again. They also learned other tricks, like if you're walking someone to the forest and shooting them, it helps if you don't look them in the eye when you do it. So they learned if you turn the person and have them face away, okay, that's one way to get around your natural sense of empathy. So they shot them from the back. They learn not to walk them to the forest one-on-one, but walk them instead in groups. Also, maybe helps you feel less empathy. So they learned like all sorts of tricks, and this book goes through like various tricks that they learned over time to make it easier to commit this horrible task and reduce the sense of empathy because of the incentives that they had. And so the basic story that we're trying to tell here is, look, if you just focus on the proximate motivators like empathy, you might miss the fact that empathy itself is endogenous and will respond to things like the incentives. As this Ordinary Men example and as our experiments are trying to go. And it's really, at least in the long run, when people have a chance to adapt, it's really going to be the social incentives the other incentives that are going to play a big role in shaping whether we're willing to commit evil. Caveat though, of course, this isn't the only thing that's going to shape whether we do evil and the only thing that shapes whether we feel empathy. Other things matter, but this is something that we'll caution about. And just to draw this to like a bigger theme, explaining aspects of our psychology, but from this more functional lens, that realizes that the proximate psychology is often quite interesting, but often endogenous. And often it helps really to think about the functional behind the scenes stuff that shape that psychology. And one tool, which I didn't bring up yet, that tends to help us understand the functional perspective that shapes our psychology is game theory.
Fascinating. Yeah, I think a common critique of game theory is that it assumes that humans are rational. Just taking a look at my own life and people's fear of sharks and maybe more significantly, the work of Kahneman and Tversky on biases, that's enough to undermine this assumption that humans are rational. So why do you think game theory is still a really useful tool to think about human irrationality?
Yeah, good, good. So obviously, huge respect for Kahneman, Tversky, and for all of the various efforts to show cognitive limitations that we have. That research is very fruitful and important. However, I guess it's also important to realize that like tools like game theory or other economic tools that assume rationality, like one way to think about them is that they're meant to model how people consciously think through things using like system two. And I think that when you read this important line of research like Kahneman and Tversky, they'll tell you the limitations of system two. They'll tell you like actually when we consciously think things through, there's all sorts of mistakes that we make. There's all sorts of limitations, cognitive constraints that prevent us from being optimal when we rely on our conscious reason. Okay. But like, that's not the only sense in which you might want to apply models of rationality, like in theory. Other processes, in addition to system two and conscious reasoning, might lead us to optimize. So one process that's well known, you know, evolution also leads to optimization. Okay. So you can have brainless amoeba that are pretty good at optimizing how to get the right, I don't know, micronutrients that they need and move in the right direction to do that. And there's all sorts of really great work that I'm obviously not an expert in that biologists do that figure out how animal form and shape behavior is well adapted to their environment. And none of that story relies on the animal being super smart and able to think things through consciously. It's just natural selection. And so it's important to realize that like game theory and other models of rationality don't require that we interpret rationality in this like conscious system two sense. But if you think about, well, evolutionary processes, and this is one I'll get to a few more, evolutionary processes can also optimize. And hence, maybe the word rationality is loaded, but the tools of game theory really just require that there's optimization going on. And so game theory is going to be relevant to biological contexts where animals are optimizing via natural selection. So game theory has a huge successful track record explaining things like long tails and peacocks or birds chirping or the ratio of males to females about 50-50 in most sexually reproducing species or vampire bats sharing blood, reciprocal altruism or animal territoriality. These are all like really important success stories where game theory models have been very well applied to this biological domain without in any way relying on conscious rationality. And without in any way being undermined by the behavioral critique from like Kahneman and Tversky.
Sorry, before we move on, could you quickly define system two thinking?
Yeah, I think roughly all I meant to be alluding to is this idea that our ability to like slowly, deliberatively, consciously reason things through, that has all sorts of limitations. Like it's going to be limited by cognitive load. It takes a lot of effort and it's susceptible to all sorts of biases, like what's easy to mentally simulate. And so there's a lot of research in the judgment and decision-making tradition that shows the problems with this reasoning. But then I guess more recently, there's all sorts of nice work, a lot of interesting newer generation of cognitive science modeling that does things like resource rationality, which says, okay, when we're trying to like estimate probabilities, we're running mental simulations and that takes a lot of effort and it's going to be imprecise and it'll be susceptible to biases as well, like ingrained adjustments. So people have tried to formalize these biases a little bit and the cognitive limitations at play. Yes, that system is imperfect, but I'm not relying on that system, that imperfect system to justify game theory. I'm relying on things like natural selection or what I hadn't got to yet is learning process, like social learning, like from imitating others and models of cultural evolution or reinforcement learning. These things are also quite good at getting to optimality and it's analogous to how natural selection does without the reliance on conscious deliberative reasoning. We're pretty good learners and we're pretty good at doing that from scarce data. We're pretty good at doing that in ways that we're not even consciously aware of happens behind the scenes. And often it will shape our tastes and our intuitions and our ideologies without us even knowing that there's some underlying function at play and without us even knowing that like that system is doing a decent job optimizing it and game theory, it's going to play a role there in shaping what preferences we might develop. And maybe just to mention one more caveat, or I think relevant point for interpreting, I guess, what I just said is if you're relying on conscious reasoning to justify optimality versus evolution or learning processes, you get a slightly different interpretation of things. And there are slightly different things that you need to worry about. So in general, conscious reasoning happens like immediately, like as a function of like your current environment. So you can use your mind to adjust to like exactly what stimuli you're facing. Whereas learning processes depend on like past data and past experiences that you have, and they tend to lag and spill over and overgeneralize to like new context and stuff. So when you're relying on learning processes to get to optimality, you do have to recognize lag and spillover effects that are imperfect. You might develop a sense of like altruism that makes sense in one context and then misapply it because of like reputational or social benefits, and then misapply it in a laboratory context that is anonymous and you're not getting those social benefits because learning processes, you internalize things and there's like a slow, it takes time and new data before you readjust. And evolution even more so. Evolution is even slower than learning. So even more so, you got to worry about lag and spillovers there.
Right. Yeah. So you have previous work that looks at this phenomenon that basically, while people are motivated to give to others, they aren't sensitive to the effect of their donations. For instance, we're willing to spend the same amount to save 2,000 versus 200,000 birds from an oil spill. So how do you explain this type of phenomenon in the context of game theory?
Yeah, cool. So I guess that's a very, very old fact that people are really insensitive. I mean, both JDM researchers have been documenting this for a while, but also there's a huge movement nowadays with effective altruism. Effective altruists have also pointed out, look, we put so much money and effort into doing good, but we're just so bad at doing it effectively. And, you know, a big part of, I guess, moral psychology, at least the part that focuses on like cooperation and altruism, asks the question, why are we so insensitive to efficacy? I think that's an important problem. What about our psychology is making us so ineffective? Okay. So if you go back to these original studies that ask people like, how much would you pay to save 2,000 dying birds that got burnt in an oil spill versus if you tell between subject, another group of participants, you ask them the same question, but instead of 2,000 birds, it's 2 birds or 200,000, so that people give the same number. They're like scope insensitive. They're insensitive to the scale of the problem. Another very similar phenomenon, this is John List has this study. John List is an experimental economist. He had people go and knock door to door, ask people to donate to charities. And when they would donate, he told them he'd match their donations 1-to-1, 2-to-1, 3-to-1, 4-to-1, and so on. And again, people are completely insensitive to the matching rate, which is another way to show that they're really not paying attention to the impact that their giving would have. Okay? So they're not sensitive to the number of birds that they would save, but also not sensitive to this multiplier of this matching rate. So in both cases, you can ask the question of like, why is it that people are willing to donate money or that this is worth money to save these birds or to help this charity, but not sensitive at all to the scope or multiplier? And I think a standard JDM type explanation for this is that when we think about the birds, we mentally simulate a representative bird and think about them like frailing around in the oil, and like that, you know, triggers our empathetic reaction, and that dictates how much money we're willing to spend. And notice that we simulated a representative bird, which means by construction, we're not going to be sensitive to the number of birds that are impacted. And so that's one classic JDM explanation for why we would be insensitive to scope multiplier for impact. It's just the heuristic that we use is itself insensitive. And I guess we would say, and I'll get to our evidence in a second, but we would caution people to be wary about the causal impact of this proximate explanation of the heuristic we're using for this set, very similar to the discussion we previously had on empathy, which is, yes, the heuristic is insensitive to impact, and that could, in some sense, explain our insensitivity to impact. But the heuristic itself is endogenous, just like empathy was. Which heuristic we choose to use is somewhat under our control. You could mentally simulate a representative sample, or you could pull out an Excel sheet and do what people in the effective altruist community do. And some decisions that we make, we do put in the effort to like calculate exact impact. And people think very hard about, for instance, their savings decisions. So when you're not making decisions on behalf of other people, but on behalf of your future self, perhaps there people are very sensitive to impact. Or at least that's what one of our experiments shows, is that when we run the same a lab analog of this John List experiment, where we have people giving to charities, and we vary the multiplier between 1 and 10, like as with John List study, people are totally insensitive to the multiplier. So they always give, I don't know, something like half. We give them $10 and we let them allocate any amount between 0 and 10 to a charity of their choice. And we multiply what they give, and they can keep what they don't give. We multiply what they give by 1, 2, 3, up till 10 between subjects. People are completely insensitive to that multiplier. But when it's a savings decision, so when we say instead of the money going to a charity of the choice, it's going to go in a between subject design, it's going to go to back to them in 6 months. Now people are very sensitive to the multiplier. You know, people are sensitive to interest rates. And the message here is just, look, we can be sensitive to magnitudes and impacts. It's not like there's a limitation in like our cognitive abilities here. It's a limitation in our motivation. And the motivation might affect what cognition, what like heuristic we use to make the decision. But that's endogenous. And we can be more sensitive if we wanted to be, as we are with savings decisions.
Yeah, I think one thing that I was interested in bringing into this discussion was your ideas around categorical versus continuous norms. So you suggest that we create categorical bans, such as prohibitions against all chemical weapons, rather than banning the individual weapons that are most harmful, and that this is a social strategy. This makes it easier to observe who is abiding by the rules and who we need to punish. Can you talk more about how these categorical events or coordination patterns promote cooperation?
Yeah, I will. And I want to tie it a little bit also just to the efficient giving stuff, because there's a common denominator about those projects, which is there's a key role of coordination in a lot of the way that social incentives work. So when you give to charities, part of why you're giving is obviously not consciously. This is at a functional, non-conscious level. It might be shaping via learning and stuff like your sense of one glow and things like that. But at a non-conscious level, your willingness to give is going to be shaped by all sorts of social benefits, like the reputational benefits you get. And reputation is very much a big, large-scale coordination problem in that, like, I don't want to treat you like you're a super nice, great person if everybody around me thinks you're a horrible person. I need to be well-coordinated in my assessment of you with all my other friends. And so reputations have this coordination element. And so too does norm enforcement. So if I think you misbehaved enough, thinking about whether or not I want to yell at you, sanction you, or cut off ties with you. One thing that I'm going to be considering, again, not consciously, but it might shape my moral intuitions, is do I think other people around me will also think you misbehave? If everybody else thinks you behave properly, then why would I want to break off ties with you or risk myself to try and punish you if all it's going to do is cause other people to like think, hey, why the hell is Russia for no reason creating this problem? But if everybody agrees that you did something wrong, then if I don't sanction you, other people will be like, dude, Moshe, like, why are you being nice to this horrible person? You're supposed to help enforce norms. And so norm enforcement, like the reputational benefits for charitable giving, have this component. It's very important for the norm enforcers to share assessments with other people and be well coordinated with other potential enforcers. So coordination, and this is where some game theory comes in, coordination really requires particular features, and certain things help make it easier or harder to coordinate. And one thing that makes it easier to coordinate is categorical variables. Having a norm against the use of chemical weapons, that's something that's relatively easy to coordinate on. It's relatively easy for us to agree when, you know, Assad used chemical weapons on his people. It's a lot harder for us to coordinate on our assessment about whether a transgression happened, whether a norm was violated, if the norm is continuous, like Assad killed too many of his civilians. What counts as too many? That's much harder to coordinate on. And so it's much harder to enforce norms. And hence, we won't develop the same moral intuitions around these more continuous variables. It's very easy to have a moral intuition that treats zero and one different, but much harder to treat 50 and 53. Right. And there we have some mathematical modeling of like how these signals affect coordination. But then we also have some experiments that show that people are very sensitive to the difference between zero and one, much more so than they're sensitive to other variation like magnitude of harm. And we try and tie this a little bit to coordination by saying, look, we also anticipate that other people will have be much more sensitive to that jump from zero to one. And to the extent that like we need to be coordinated with other people, we'll anticipate that and care about that. And to the extent that we actually are just thinking about avoiding somebody beating us, and we're going to be, let me tell you the experimental paradigm. Okay, so you decide between two die to roll, and they have different numbers of like red and black dots on them. Okay, one of them has more red dots than the other. So one of them has four red dots and one of them has two red dots. And when a red dot is rolled, you get more money and I get less money. Okay. So the selfish thing to do is to pick the die with more red dots. And some people do the selfish thing, some people don't. There's obviously variation, but there's a few important things that we check. One is we have third parties who look at which die you roll. And they can pay money to sanction you. So this is all incentivized, like standard econ scale again. So they could pay a dollar to take away $3 from you. And they see which die you chose. And so obviously they're going to sanction you more when you choose the selfish die than when you choose die with fewer red dots, the more pro-social die. But importantly, what we show is that people are completely insensitive to the number red dots that differ between those two dice. So if it's 3 red dots versus 4 red dots, you choose the 4 red dot one that's selfish, you get punished. Now, if in a different set of subjects, it's 2 versus 6 red dots, so it's much more of a selfish choice. Or if we change the payoff, so it hurts me a lot more when the die lands not on a red side. In both those cases, you're not only choosing selfishly, you're choosing in a more selfish way. Like the degree to which you're selfish, the third parties that are punishing you, they're completely insensitive. So they punish the same analogous to our claim about efficient giving. Just like there, people were insensitive to the match. Here, people are insensitive to the magnitude of harm that you caused or the degree to which you're selfish. They are sensitive to whether you choose the selfish thing, okay, but not to the degree. Then one more treatment that we have here that highlights the role of coordination is if instead of third party punishing, instead of paying money to punish the person who chose the selfish die, instead they choose how much to pay to avoid interacting, to avoid being the recipient from the same die roller. You'll make the same decision again, but now it'll be this other subject who gets to be the recipient. They can pay, they choose how much money they would pay to avoid being the recipient against you. So they're very sensitive to like how much harm the die roll would cause or how selfish. So again, like with the efficient giving study, you can be sensitive to magnitude of harm or degree of selfishness when it's more of a prior choice or avoidance type decision than when it's a moralistic outrage, third-party punishment type decision where we think that's more shaped by norm enforcement or coordination.
Yeah, so seems like the data and the science that you've shared with me thus far paints a bit of a pessimistic picture of human nature. We seem to care about the impact of our altruism mostly when we're helping ourselves or our families, and our empathy seems to be regulated by these kind of selfish incentives. Has this altered the way that you view human nature in general and our capacity for altruism? Do you see any paths to improving our altruistic tendencies?
Yeah, I agree with you that it is cynical in that I guess like the argument, the implicit argument is that, well, even when we're behaving altruistically, obviously I'm not unique in making this argument, somewhat common in, I guess, the moral psychology literature, that our sense of altruism oftentimes at some level, at some root level, it's gonna be selfish. But it's important to distinguish between it being selfish on a conscious level versus at the level of what shapes our learning process or our evolutionary process. And I guess like maybe there's some philosophical disagreement we could have here, but I think of course what shapes our learning and evolutionary process has to be in some sense selfish because evolution and learning processes are greedy processes. They optimize. That's just how they work. There's no way around them. But of course that doesn't mean that that can't lead to altruistic behavior in a very real sense. And it can, as we mentioned with vampire rats, you can evolve reciprocal altruism. And in humans, you could develop all sorts of very strong norms and very strong, which can affect things like moral intuitions and warm-blown empathy that do cause us to do a lot of good. And in fact, at a proximate level, can feel very altruistic. And I think the fact that proximately it feels altruistic does make a big difference. So it's not like we're consciously always being strategic and calculating how to get the best reputational benefits. And maybe that's another, if we have the time, another topic we can get into is when you are consciously being strategic, it does feel very different. And it has all sorts of implications that make it very different when it's evolution learning that's being selfish. That's an important distinction. But I think it's also worth mentioning that, okay, these processes, even though the learning and evolution are themselves greedy, they could lead to behavior that is, in a very real sense, altruistic. But altruistic in ways, as we've discussed, that oftentimes are inefficient or not really optimal, like you get inefficient categorical norms or inefficient giving and or empathy, being able to be sidestepped, you're motivated enough to do harm. So those are, I think, real limitations on human behavior because of the way these greedy processes work, because of the game theoretic logic that might be behind learning and evolution. I think that those are real constraints that we need to consider. They're real. We can't just ignore them. And the data is there too that people are very inefficient when they give and they cause all sorts of harm and stuff. But that logic can also give us hints as to how to get people to give more efficiently. So for instance, if you make efficacy, common knowledge that can help get around this coordination problem and help ensure that reputations are more dependent on impact. So you can get some insight as to how to make giving more efficient or how to create norms that are more pro-social and things like that. And I guess that's another interesting discussion we can have. Another important caveat is there is some sense, and we can debate this for hours on end, that reasoning could play a role and might be able to override our innate predispositions or these greedy learning and evolutionary processes. So we can think through what would be good for humanity or efficient. And I think there, I'm also going to end up being more on the cynical side in that I don't really think we can like consciously think our way through overcoming learning and evolution. The way that we reason is also shaped by learning evolution and our motives that are going to be driving that. And so it's not really that those, that reasoning overcomes those processes. Reasoning is one tool we use and that's also shaped by those processes. And see, reasoning is also often going to be used for selfish ends and won't necessarily get us around this. But that said, reasoning can impact our behavior in that, for instance, you can capture things like consistency motives, so the need to be able to justify your behavior, be plausible deniability. And sometimes that could be used to push people to do more pro-social stuff, even if I think we're only responding to that because it helps us gain our reputation as being trustworthy or principled or things like that. It nevertheless can drive real change. So one example that I like to talk about, and this is work with Manvir Singh and I, we talk a lot about principal behavior. And I guess, we're not the first to think about this, but I guess one of the main points that we're trying to make is that reasoning can be used to convince other people that we're behaving consistent with these trustworthy motives, but that can constrain us because you need to make arguments that you're behaving consistently. And that means that, for instance, if in the American Revolution, I want to make the argument that equality and liberty is a good reason to throw off our British overlords. Again, we would give a similar argument like I did with the Einsatzgruppe and like I did with efficient giving and like the availability heuristic, which is for the most part, that's just a justification people used. The main motive was really they wanted to pay less taxes. They wanted to have more power to steal land from Indians, like black people, and to continue doing all the selfish things that normal human beings often pursue and often find justifications for. And the justification that they found handy then was liberty and equality. And of course, they got pushed a lot on how, like, well, they were defining liberty and equality in very self-serving ways. Like, what they meant by liberty was the liberty to own slaves and steal indigenous land. And what they meant by equality was, like, equality with other white people in England. They certainly didn't mean equality with black people. But they did get pushed back on this hypocrisy, and that actually affected people because, well, they need to try and convince people that they're really motivated by these like highfalutin principles of liberty and equality, that meant that they take a hypocrisy hit by owning slaves. And so some of the founding fathers did feel compelled to free their slaves. And in fact, they felt compelled to put this highfalutin language in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, which later abolitionists and civil rights activists and suffragettes could cite and could say, look, you're being hypocritical here. You have these ideas of equality, but like you're not behaving consistently with that. And that actually did have real impact. And so that did lead to this expanding moral circle. And so that's like a case where you might argue our reasoning is, or some argue our reasoning got us to overcome these like selfish motives. But I guess I might put a more cynical lens on that, which is we have these consistency motives, this desire to be principled and to become trustworthy. And that can sometimes bind us, especially when the costs are relatively low and the gains for being appearing principle and getting trust are relatively high. So I would argue there's still some economic logic that's going to come into play here. And that makes it somewhat different from the overcoming your innate predisposition story. But that yes, principles and reason can play some role.
Yeah, that makes sense. I guess one question that falls out of this is how something like true altruistic action plays part in your model. So say someone runs into a burning building, risking their own life to save a stranger's child. There's no one around. There's almost certainly going to be no reward for them down the line. How do you think about that kind of selfless and like self-risking type of action?
Yeah. So I guess a few thoughts on that topic. So I guess one is clearly people who are acting selflessly in that sense are, hey, get to be much more trustworthy and desirable social partners. So yes, at a proximal level, they're not thinking about that. And at a proximal level, they are acting in a very real sense, more genuinely altruistic. But you might wonder if that in turn, that acting genuinely altruistic in a more principled, innate, intuitive sense than a calculated strategic altruist, that genuine altruism is itself learned or evolved because it makes you much more trustworthy and desirable as a social partner. So we have a little bit of work trying to, again, use game theory to argue people who are genuine altruists in turn get additional social benefits for that. And that without consciously thinking things through, that could still shape through learning and evolution, this general sense of altruism. Then I guess there's this other story about, as I mentioned before, like altruism, like other aspects of our preferences and ideologies and intuition and stuff I learned and evolved. And that's going to have lag and spillover effects, which I alluded to. I'm glad I managed to throw that caveat in earlier, because that'll play a role too, which is, yes, altruism might have learned or evolved in situations with our reputational benefits, but because of the way internalization works, because of the way learning processes and evolution work, they're not going to be perfectly adapted to any given context. And so in this context, you might not get the social benefits from behaving, or it might not be worth the huge cost of putting your own life at risk, but you still do it because you develop this as like a gut intuition or an instinctual reaction. And the fact that it's an intuition already suggests you're not consciously calculating things through using system two, like we talked about, but that intuition itself is the result of possibly a learning or evolved process. I guess, of course, there's some evidence like Dave Rand's work that like a lot of times when we are cooperative, it's very intuitive. And I guess, yeah, the story Dave tells there, which I guess we would agree with, is that in many contexts, it pays off to be cooperative, at least in our culture and in our environment. Our huge reputation, I guess Joe Henrich talks about this too, is in our society, there are huge reputational benefits to being cooperative with anonymous strangers. In other cultures, there might be more of a sense that it's important to put your kin first or your tribe first. We've developed this more anonymized market-based system where you're supposed to treat even anonymous strangers well. At least there's that norm and there's benefits for that. And that could develop these intuitions around this like expansive moral circle, which then might lead you to behave in some cynical sense, suboptimally in this particular case.
Yeah, I guess that's a kind of interesting silver lining to the story, that incentives might be playing a huge role in our altruistic action, but we actually have social incentives to cooperate. So pivoting a little bit, I'm a big fan of the rapper MF Doom. And you make an argument in your book that the intricacies of the rhyme scheme in his music might actually be playing a kind of signaling role that we're able to catch on to and that we appreciate. Can you talk more about this?
Yeah. So I guess so far we've been talking a lot about social preferences and altruism and norms and stuff like that. But I'm glad you're bringing up a new topic, which is like our sense of aesthetics, including music. And obviously there's many interesting stories about what shapes our sense of aesthetics. And the story that you're alluding to that I guess I'll expand on in a moment is it's only one thing. I certainly don't want to say it's the only thing there is to aesthetics. But I guess the point that we try to make in this one book chapter is that one interesting aspect of aesthetics is that there's often artificial constraints. And depending on the art movement or the genre of music, those constraints might look very different. And it could be, it's always hard to rule out with these signaling stories that there isn't like a direct real benefit to having this constraint. Like maybe the fact that there's like this very complicated rhyming scheme, maybe that somehow does something rhythmically to our brain that we don't fully understand, that for some reason it's soothing or riles you up. I don't know. So it's hard to rule that out, but it seems like it's an artificial constraint that in these rhyming schemes, it's really, really hard to tell story or to give spontaneous insults or to make yourself sound really cool. There's all these goals that you might have in a song, but at the same time, you're forced to fit certain lines or stanzas or words to rhyme with each other that oftentimes makes it harder for the listener to understand exactly what you're referencing or exactly what you mean. It seems to just make the job hard. And you see this a lot in art and music, these like artificial rules that seem to just make the artist's job harder. And yet the really good creative artists still manage to make us feel very emotive when we hear it convey an interesting idea. They still manage to do that despite the constraint. Cubism, you have to chop up the image into a bunch of blocks and then spin the pieces around so you see the same image from multiple angles at once. That seems to just make it harder for us to recognize the referent in there. But that was one of the rules that you had to do as a cubist painter. And the really good cubist painters were still able to have an impact on their audience despite this constraint. So different movements like cubism have these constraints that seem to the really creative artists still manage very well to have an impact on their audience despite the constraint. And so that seems like a puzzle of why art often has these artificial constraints imposed. And I guess the classic signaling story is, well, the people who are especially creative are going to manage despite these constraints. And so one way to show off that you're creative is to manage within this system of constraints. And yeah, that's just one example where constant signaling has some nice insights on our sense of aesthetics. And of course, it's again internalized. So it's not like we're consciously, we listen to a rap song and we're like, oh, wow, that artist, I like listening to this because I can tell that the artist is good at conveying a message despite this artificial portrayal. No, it just sounds really cool. And like, maybe you should go art. And you know, that sense of awe, that sense of it sounds really cool, is, we would argue, an internalized intuition or a feeling or a sense of aesthetics that we've learned at an underlying non-conscious level because of the signaling logic.
Yeah, I guess along a similar line, your work suggests that gestures like public apologies and big royal coronations that play an important role in society are also kind of enabling social coordination along similar symbolic tracks. Could you explain the logic behind that?
Yeah, good. So separate from moral intuitions and norms and altruism, and separate from aesthetics, another important set of applications that we talk about are like symbolic acts, like performative speech acts, like when people say, I love you, or I do, or I'm sorry. These words seem to matter. And you can wonder, why do mere words, why do we make such a big deal out of mere words? And then likewise, a lot of actions, which seem to not do anything materially real, we make a big deal out of them, like coronations, as you mentioned, like bowing down or shaking hands. These things, these very symbolic acts, we again make a very big deal out of them. And it's not immediately obvious why symbolic acts or performative speech affect us so much. And again, proximately, it just feels very important. Like the first time your partner says, I love you, again, has a huge emotional reaction. And really, it might really deepen the relationship. Maybe it'll tell you guys you're on the wrong page. I don't know. It can do many things. But like, the one thing it doesn't do is, it's not insignificant, even though it's just words. And it's not insignificant, even if they're words that like, you fully anticipate, or you already knew that they felt that way. The fact that they said it can still matter a lot. And that's often true with these symbolic gestures and these performative speech acts, is they can matter a lot, even if they're not really conveying anything. And so the question is, why at a proximate level do they matter so much? A story that we give in our book, we spend a lot of time in our book talking about like coordination and common knowledge, and this is one important application of it. And I think Michael Schrey was the first person to have this idea that ancient common knowledge are key to performative speech and symbolic acts. But the basic story, which we spell out with some toy models in the book, is that it's really, really important for us, again, to agree on who's king, especially if like the last king died. It's very important for, if two people are in a romantic relationship, for them to be on the same page. Don't want to be sacrificing, you know, what city you live in, or spending so much time invested in a relationship with the other, you know, is thinking about leaving in 3 weeks, or is they're not putting in much effort. So it's important to be well coordinated on like how deep and invested and committed is this. So there's a coordination element to that too. Saying I'm sorry might coordinate two people on, do you have a right to do that thing again? So when the U.S. accidentally killed some Pakistani soldiers when we were fighting the war in Afghanistan, Pakistan was our allies. We accidentally killed Pakistani soldiers. It was very important in Pakistan that we apologize for that. And why did they make such a big deal? They ended up closing our trade routes, and it costed us, you know, an estimated $1 billion because of the problems that were incurred in our tense relationship with Pakistan when we refused to apologize. Why did we make such a big deal out of this apology? Well, the idea is that like saying I'm sorry indicates, well, we acknowledge that you have rights to like Pakistani airspace, and we need to ask permission before we do these raids, and we need to be more careful and compensate for your loss and things like that. So it's just something about the right to do this thing in the future, and whether or not you have a right to get angry if I do it again. So it can really affect like coordination on like rights in our future relationship if I apologize. So that we argue is why people make such a big deal out of saying I'm sorry. So again, coordination, whenever you have symbolic acts and whenever you have performative speech acts, they're going to matter when coordination is key. And then another thing is for them to matter, it needs to be very explicit and direct and undeniable.
Right, yeah. I think I'll never see public apologies quite the same way again. So we're nearing the end of our time, but at the end of these episodes, we like to do a segment that's a little more personal and maybe discuss your own journey through academia. So one question that I'd hope to ask is, it looks like you've been a lecturer in economics, psychology, mathematics, and evolutionary biology at various points in your career. Can you tell me a little bit more about your path through academia and what led you to bridge across fields in this way? And also whether there are any through lines or cool questions that you've kind of been following throughout your journey.
Well, I guess I've always been interested in the question of like, what shapes our beliefs and preferences? Where do those come from? I think that's been the driving question. And I guess from an early stage, I thought, taking this functional perspective and thinking through like the underlying game theory logic that we're not consciously aware of would play an important role, like I was reading Dawkins, The Selfish Gene, in high school, and I guess that's what gave me like the broad idea to game theory would be important. Oh, theory is talking about animal behavior and ground progress. Maybe it's relevant for our sense of morality and stuff like that. And obviously, I'm not the only one to have that idea, but I remember having that thought in high school. And I guess since then, I thought a little bit about what the optimal path to work on that as a career. And I don't know if it's optimal. I mean, I'm sure many people have figured out better ways to navigate academia. But I guess I figured that it would help to get a solid core background in game theory, you know, learning some psychology on the side and some evolution on the side, but have that core mathematical background that might be more unique and might allow me to have this solid foundation that gives me a little bit of a comparative advantage to tackle these problems in a way that other people haven't. It seemed like that was worth investing in. But unlike, I guess, just a pure game theory course, which I did end up doing an undergrad and a PhD in econ, wanted to make sure that I keep my eye on the ball and also think a lot about the kinds of phenomena that I was really motivated by, not just doing math. So I was constantly taking psychology courses and reading history and trying to keep up with those literatures. And I guess I've been fortunate, like you said, to be, you know, overlapping with these other departments so that I can benefit from their insights and ideas and methods. But yeah, it was really important for me to get that core game theory background. I guess I also picked up experimental econ approach. My PhD supervisor was an experimental economist. And then I guess I also picked up some like evolutionary modeling approaches from a later mentor, Marcin Novak.
Wow, that's fascinating. I'd love to get your recommendation on history books at some point. But thanks for sharing that. I guess one last question I had was, what advice would you give to your younger self about how to find questions that are kind of worth asking, questions that can fuel this type of academic career that has spanned multiple fields?
Well, I mean, I guess I love reading history and I love watching documentaries and I love chatting with people and going to random seminars. I guess I do all of that a lot. It takes a lot of time. So I don't know. Like you have to be like really intellectually motivated and maybe have low opportunity costs. I don't know. But so I'm sure I would recommend this to everybody. Maybe people had better things to do in high school than read Richard Dawkins. But yeah, I think I spend a lot of time reading and that helps. And even now, I guess I go to seminars in psychology and in econ and in the law school and in the Kennedy school pretty regularly. And I'm always reading random history books. Every week or two, I pick up another history book. But I don't know, it's all time consuming. So I'm not sure I'd recommend it, but I love it. And I guess I get a lot of ideas from doing that. But I guess I also get a ton from reading research papers. Obviously, every time I read a paper, I think, okay, what is this paper missing? I think, what is the key insight here? What could my approach add to it? Or what is something that like academia as a whole, maybe me included, like still don't understand about this topic? So I'm constantly asking myself those questions also when I go to seminars. I think that's important. But the other thing that's crucial, at least for me, is I spend a ton of time talking to friends. And again, maybe other people are less narrowly focused than me, but all my friends are in academia and we're always talking about puzzling aspects of human social behavior. And so every time I'm reading a history book or watching a documentary or in a seminar, I'll text a friend and I'll be like, oh, I noticed this interesting observation. What's going on there? I try very hard to articulate what's puzzling about it or what doesn't make sense about it. And even if I don't have the answer, it helps expel out the question. I mean, sometimes we'll argue back and forth and then you get an insight, but, you know, just asking questions.
Great. Well, Moshe Hoffman, thank you so much for agreeing to meet today and for making time. This was really fascinating. Thanks for listening. So following Robert Cialdini's advice on this podcast, let's see if I can convince you to take about 5 seconds of your valuable time and leave us a review on Spotify. This podcast has been a labor of love by several wonderful young folks here in the department, and we've been surprised by the ever-increasing reach the podcast has had. We're near 500,000 downloads a year and a half since we started, with tens of thousands of new downloads and thousands of new followers every month in nearly every country around the world. Help us make even more people excited about psych by leaving us a review or subscribing to our No Spam Substack at Stanford SciPod to connect with other listeners, or shoot us an email with your thoughts or suggestions at stanfordpsychpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you and have a wonderful psyched day.